You're a rich girl and you're gone too far, 'cause you know it don't matter anyway. You can rely on the old man's money. You can rely on the old man's money. It's a bitch, girl, but it's gone too far, 'cause you know it don't matter anyway. Say money, money won't get you too far, get you too far.
What's up, Wisconsin and beyond? My name is Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. And as it is the 3 o'clock hour, it is time for Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. Today, we are talking about the Great Economy Project. Don't worry if you don't know what that is, because I've got two great guests to explain it all to you. This is all about really talking about the untapped power that each and every one of you, every working person in these United States has, especially in states like Wisconsin, not just in this next election cycle, but on the day after, starting on November 6th. This is about all of us understanding how the economy works for us as the middle class, and just as importantly, how it doesn't. And let's get together, all of us, because we have a commonality of interests, because there's going to be a big fight in 2025. Not just over our economy, but over tax policies and about fundamentally how we view middle-class Americans. I am really excited about this because voting is already underway. Alabama mailed ballots last week. Wisconsin's mailing out ballots this Thursday. So we're in the countdown to November 5th. What is it, like 50 days away? Holy cow. But both of my guests today say that as important as November 5th is, November 6th, the day after the election, is, if not just as important, maybe even more important. It's the battle for the future of America. So with us today are Erica Payne and Kat Hadley. Erica is founder and president of the Patriotic Millionaires, a Wharton grad, and the co-author with Morris Pearl of Tax the Rich, How Lies, Loopholes, and Lobbyists Make the Rich Even Richer. And we're joined by Kat Hadley, director of the Great Economy Project, long-time Michigan economic justice advocate, and she is a trustee on the Ann Arbor Library Board. I love the library. I go to Milwaukee Public Library's big annual foundation fundraiser every year and crack open my checkbook. So important. Erica, let's start with you. Why do you and the Patriotic Millionaires think that this broader fight, you know, like step one of the fight is go vote on election day, diligence your candidates. But this broader fight really is going to start after election day. What comes after the, why are we talking about November 6th? We haven't even gotten to November 5th yet, Erica.
Well, we always like to think ahead here at the Patriotic Millionaire. So in 2025, a huge portion of the American tax code expires. And so when those tax provisions expire, we have an opportunity to put in place the kind of tax system this country needs and this country deserves. In 2017, on a party line vote, Republicans in the House and the Senate and President Donald Trump put a new tax code in place in the United States. It covered every single aspect of taxes, from estate taxes to personal income taxes to exemptions to corporate taxes and everything in between. In 2018, for the first time in American history, billionaires paid a lower effective tax rate than every single other group in America. Congress never does something until they're forced to do it. In 2025, we have the opportunity to write a tax code that will turn the Titanic, that will get this country moving in the right direction, and that will address this destabilizing, cancerous inequality that is about to eat our democratic, capitalistic society from the inside out. So 2025, huge year for America. And think about it. We turn 250 years old, Maggie, in 2026. Let's say happy birthday, America, with a tax code that we need and deserve, that'll make sure that our economy is structured in such a way that we have a stable, prosperous, and inclusively prosperous nation.
I like the way Morris puts it, Erica, which is, I want to be a rich guy or a prosperous guy in a prosperous nation filled with other rich people and prosperous people. Like, that's the objective. And we have the tools to help start to make that a reality. Erica, 2 years ago, the PMs started the Great Economy Project. We even have a chapter of it here in the state of Wisconsin. What is the Great Economy Project and why did the PM start it? What's the goal?
Sure. So the goal of the Great Economy Project is to build a bipartisan coalition of working Americans to ensure that we have the kind of economy that we need to have a stable, prosperous country, regardless of which political party is in charge. So if you look back over the last 60, 70 years, two things have happened. The wage floor, the bottom has fallen out of the wage floor. So basically the middle class has nothing to stand on. And all the gains of productivity have gone to the top people in the country. Simultaneously, tax rates for the richest people in the country go down, 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 regardless of what political party is in charge. So this has led to the highest level of economic inequality we have seen in 100 years. We're playing a game of economic Jenga where we're pulling off the bottom, pulling off the middle, loading all of that stuff up on the top, and the whole thing's about to collapse. In 2025, we can fix it. But the only way we can fix it is if a bipartisan majority of Americans demand that we fix it, because we have a big time Republican Party problem. And we also have some of a Democratic Party problem. So we've got to solve the problem on both sides. What Pat and I did starting 2 years ago was we picked out what we think are some of the most powerful places in the country, places that have a huge working class population, populations that are getting screwed by the economy, regardless of which party is in charge, and groups that are represented by folks who can really do something about this. So we started a program in North Carolina, we've got a program going in Wisconsin, and we've got one going in Michigan. And what we do with the Great Economy Project is we come in with a bunch of our members, and over a series of dinners, we talk to regular folks across party lines about exactly how the economy is rigged, the specifics of it, from CEO pay to tax policy to wage policy. They can see the whole picture. And then we help them use their own political power to demand the changes that they need to see in the country.
I think in many ways, I think of this as responsive and trying to help people understand why people are so angry in many cases, why they feel left behind. Kat, you're the director of the Great Economy Project. How is it going so far? If somebody listening right now is angry, if they do feel like they're not getting ahead, like their kids may not do better than they are doing, and they're ticked off about it, what do you have to say to those folks? How is the Great Economy Project helping to respond to people that are bringing, I think, a totally legitimate level of frustration to the table with policymakers?
Well, I would say that you're not alone. I think a lot of times when we talk about our economy, it's very much a conversation about, you know, your personal, like what you've done. And it's not that there's no accountability for things we've done in our past, but the idea is that there have been policies in place that have been there that have made your wallet not stretch as far and made it harder to pay rent on time. And we've seen the floor fall out from beneath us. I think Erica talks a lot about a broken social contract, and that's what we have. So we need your help fixing that. And what we've seen in both Wisconsin and North Carolina is people step up to that plate. So that means going and talking to their neighbors, being at community fairs, just having these conversations about how this is stacked against them, the importance of your own voice. Because I think for a lot of people, they feel like, what's the point? You know, what's the point? They're not going to listen to me. And then in the reverse, when you go talk to lawmakers, they'll tell you, well, nobody's complaining about this. Nobody's complaining about minimum wage to me, so it must not be an issue. Which, you know, as somebody that worked for minimum wage for a long time, that wasn't the top of my mind.
Yeah, people are too busy working.
Yeah.
Two different jobs.
Maggie, yeah. That's exactly right. We'll hear from lawmakers sometimes because this minimum wage issue, what is known as the wage floor, the wage floor has not been raised since 2009. So in the United States of America today in 2024, it is legal in Wisconsin in North Carolina and a bunch of other states, it is legal to pay someone for a dollar of their time to pay them $7.25 an hour. Yeah. That adds up for full-time work to $15,000 a year. There is not a single county in the entire country where a single adult with no children can support themselves on $15,000 a year. The median cost of living in the United States of America is $40,000 a year.
That translates to $20. I wish we would start calling it a fair wage, right? Mm-hmm. Because a minimum wage, we should be saying, it is the very least that corporations get away with paying us and that our elected officials permit them to pay us. Kat, when you look at the tax fight next year, what is the one or two really important things? What do you want the Great Economy Project to impact? Because when I step back and given all of the discussions we've had here on the show, I would be saying to middle-class people, and we can talk about it, buybacks, right, CEO pay, the tax dodges, all that. What we've got at root here, right, is the cost of government being shifted from the wealthiest and the wealthiest corporations onto the backs of the middle class, with the ultimate objective to pay the middle class less, tax them more, and frankly, defund some of the systems that every American relies on, systems like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. So when you look at what the plan is for next year and this tax fight, what are the first couple of objectives for the Great Economy Project?
Well, I think that really we need to look at something like equalizing capital gains and ordinary income. And I think that for us as a movement, we need all hands on deck. We need everyone here. Our amazing team in Wisconsin has been writing op-eds. They've been at every event. They're going to have an event actually later today, a Get Out the Vote event in Platteville. It's going to be at the Belmont Convention Center, but they're out there every day talking to people. And that's what we need. We need people to get involved. And then we need people to push back, come this election. You know, you're going to be, a lot of people are asking for stuff. I'm in Michigan. I get a lot of mailers, but you know, November 6th, we need all hands on deck because we need lawmakers to know that this is an issue and that they can't get away with not fixing this for us anymore.
We got to take a quick little breath here. We got to take some, pay some of our bills. I'm Maggie Dawn. I'm with Erica Payne, founder and president of the Patriotic Millionaires, and Kat Hadley, director of the Great Economy Project. We're going to be back in just a moment. We're going to talk about why. You're just joining us. It is the 3 o'clock hour here on the Maggie Dawn Show. That means it's Maggie and the Millionaires talking money, 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 because that's what this is actually about. You know, some candidates may tell you that all your economic woes and worries will simply be washed away if we vilify certain groups of people or we build a wall high enough. But the reality of the matter is it's more complicated than that. It is actually about the money. It's actually about how we treat wages versus wealth. It's about how CEOs line their pockets. Now, I've got two great guests to help us understand that. Erica Payne, founder and president of the Patriotic Millionaires, and Kat Hadley, director of the Great Economy Project. Kat, we were talking about one key element of the fight that begins and must be sustained starting the day after Election Day on November 6th. Is simply saying that capital gains and income should be taxed at the same rate. This is actually bipartisan, is it not? I mean, middle-class folks are Republicans, Democrats, independents, uninterested, purple, polka-dotted. It's a bipartisan middle-class issue, is it not?
No, it absolutely is. But I think as somebody that's been an advocate for over a decade, you can have really popular things with every day on the street. I worked in maternal health expansion for a long time, and both sides would tell us, you know, we're all about this. We want to support you, but no legislation gets passed. So we really need people to join us in this fight and push back and say, you know, you have to fix this, because oftentimes it's just, oh, the tax code is complicated and maybe there's a reason for that. And then also that it's just not a priority for everyday people. It's not my voters' everyday priority. So we need people to be with us in this fight, emailing, calling, sending postcards, texting, all of those things, and talking to their neighbors. And we're lucky that we have an amazing team on the ground here in Richland Center, who've expanded even. They're out in Sauk and Iowa counties now, and talking to people every day about how important these issues are, how they impact them, and how these people do have a voice. They just need to exercise that muscle. And the first time is really scary, but after that, it's, you know, I always joke that you realize that politicians are three kids in a trench coat. And the second you realize that, it's a lot more approachable to call them all the time with your issues. So, yeah.
I've got the image now, Kat. Three kids in a trench coat. I love it. Erica, why Wisconsin? Why does this matter so very much for Wisconsinites?
Wisconsin is a fantastic state for us to be having a tax conversation in. You've got two incredible, incredible vehicles for your viewpoints and your two senators. We've got Tammy Baldwin, who is Senator Tammy Baldwin. She is probably one of the single best tax champions in the United States Senate. She has gone after some of the stupidest, most inane tax loopholes that are benefiting only the richest people, and she has shown herself to be a great champion. She needs to be shored up because she has a lot of middle of the road and right wing colleagues that she's going to have to convince in 2025. And then you all also have Senator Ron Johnson, who is on the Senate Finance Committee. This is the committee where all of the tax legislation will ultimately get decided, because legislation comes out of the House. And so whoever controls the House will put that legislation forward, but most likely, not to get too much into legislative details, but next year's tax bill will be passed on what's called a budget reconciliation vote. It's a special kind of legislation that allows legislation to get passed on a 51 vote threshold. The Senate will be very, very close. Ron Johnson is on the Senate Finance Committee. And I got to tell you, the preview of this tax fight that I had last week when I was in a Senate Finance Committee hearing for 3 hours, and your senator got up there and blithered some of the most incorrect, intentionally misleading nonsense I have ever heard. The folks in Wisconsin need to get your phones ringing to call Senator Ron Johnson and tell him it's time to put his money where his mouth is and fix a tax code that he last week called grotesque. It is grotesque. Let me tell you his phone number. His phone number is 202-224-3121. 202-224-3121. Ron Johnson and Tammy Baldwin, those senators are going to have a huge amount to do.
Call Senator Johnson, please let me know here at Civic Media by calling or texting if he ever gets back to you, because I've heard that Senator Ron Johnson does not return constituent calls. People do not hear from him. It frightens me that the gentleman that's running against Tammy Baldwin has a net worth somewhere north of $200 million, and that Ron Johnson has a net worth somewhere north of $50 million. Here's who I don't want defining the tax code: multimillionaires with generational wealth. Who do you think they're going to craft a tax code for? People like themselves. That's just ridiculous. If you look at Tammy Baldwin's record on a tax code that works for the middle class, it is evident that she actually cares about the middle class. Erica, last week we talked to Bob Lord. I know that you referenced his testimony before the Senate Finance Committee, as well as some of the nonsense and drivel and doublespeak that Ron Johnson was slinging about in that very hearing when he deigned to appear. Mr. Lord is the VP for tax policy for the Patriotic Millionaires. What was your bottom line takeaway from that Senate hearing? Because I went back and watched it myself, and I had a thought, but I want to hear from you because you were in the room.
I have to tell you, Maggie, it was a frustrating and also enlightening experience that I think we can pull a lot of good lessons out of. The first lesson that I had is that these lawmakers, regardless of what political party they are in, do not seem to recognize the degree of the threat that we face in inequality. People might be concerned about Trump, becoming president again, I want us to be more concerned about the preconditions that led to the rise of an authoritarian figure. We are at 100-year levels of inequality. We have a tax code that guarantees we will become more unequal more quickly over time. We're already at 100-year levels of inequality. And in the Senate Finance Committee kickoff to the 2025 tax bill, your Senator Ron Johnson talked about how changing this tax system was going to hurt small business. Well, you know, we've got a $26 million estate exemption in the tax code. If your small business is worth $26 million, we can have a perfectly reasonable conversation about what needs to happen after that.
We're going to have to leave it there. I just point to that, right? $27 million will pass without a penny of tax paid. Maybe we can start there. Maybe we can start with capital gains tax being taxed. Capital gains being taxed like income. There's so much more. You can find all of it here every day at 3 p.m. It is always Maggie and the Millionaires talking money. My thanks to Erica Payne, founder and president of the Patriotic Millionaires, and Kat Hadley, director of the Great Economy Project. Go call Ron Johnson and tell him to start treating the middle class fairly. 202-224-3121. Tell him Maggie sent you.
Maggie and the Millionaire sent you.
That's damn right. We need a fair tax code. Wisconsinites deserve a fair tax code. And I'll say this, last and finally. I don't care who you talk to in the state of Wisconsin, I hear two things all the time. I want more affordable childcare, and I want our public educational institutions to be funded. Well, we can start by taxing the rich more. That's a good place to start, to fund those essential programs that help small businesses and the entire middle class. Thanks so much, ladies. We'll be back with so much more after these brief messages here on the Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, Wisconsin and beyond. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. It's a big privilege and perk of this job to get to talk to people who are doing incredibly important work to make our country fulfill its earliest promise. Last week, we were joined on Friday by Representative Jim Clyburn to honor the celebration of Black excellence that the White House had. This week, it is my privilege to be joined by Dr. Deetra Trent, Executive Director of the White House's Initiative on Historically Black Colleges and Universities. And the White House is hosting HBCU Week because the Biden-Harris administration has announced another over $1 billion investment, which makes it, frankly, record-breaking, topping $16 billion, now $17 billion under the Biden-Harris administration in invested dollars in HBCUs. Welcome, Dr. Trent. Why does this matter so much?
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. It matters because our students matter, and this administration is investing in the future of our country. This president has always said that an investment in HBCUs is an investment in America's future. We know that HBCUs are producers of some of the greatest talent especially the greatest Black talent in the country. We can see that by our many examples. The vice president herself, HBCUs educate over 80% of the federal judges who are Black federal judges. And today are HBCU graduates. Over 80%, 70% of doctors and dentists are HBCU graduates. And so when we talk about investing in HBCUs, we really are talking about investing in our future. 40% of Blacks in STEM graduated from an HBCU. So we are talking about diversifying our country's workforce in order that we can continue to outcompete and out-innovate other countries. It is necessary for us to invest in these schools.
I was blessed to attend a majority minority, as the old nomenclature was, high school, and watched so many of my talented colleagues go on to education at HBCUs, which it was wonderful to hear from them as they progressed in their careers. They are some of the Black doctors and dentists and engineers that I know and celebrate, and I'm so privileged to be friends with today. One of the things that I think is really incredible is that this level of investment has never been seen before, and that it is so critical in this moment. Dr. Trent, this continues the legacy of the Biden-Harris administration investing in Black communities and Black young people of promise. And the results that come from HBCUs outstrip the Ivy Leagues, do they not?
They absolutely do outstrip the Ivy Leagues, especially when it comes to African Americans coming from low-income families. 75% of HBCUs students are Pell eligible, which means they are low income. Over 50% are first generation. And HBCUs have historically done a much better job with educating and getting these students to completion than any other school, any other universities in the country. So these are very special places. I am that student. Mm. I went to an HBCU. I was on a Pell Grant. I was first generation. And so I'm an example of what an HBCU can do for students who come from low-income families and students who wouldn't necessarily have that opportunity at other predominantly white institutions. And so, it is absolutely important that we continue to invest.
I want to ask you one last question. I began today's show by listening to some of actor John Leguizamo's speech yesterday at the Emmys, and he spoke very specifically to the power and importance of representation. I can think of probably no more important place than in a classroom, in a learning and teaching environment, for Black students to have, the right, the opportunity to be taught by Black professors. How critical is that for a young Black student, Dr. Trent? And then I'd like you to just give us some last thoughts on, again, the Biden-Harris administration's legacy of their commitment to Black and brown folks in this country.
Well, I appreciate that. I think that anytime you are able, I'm going to talk from my experience at Hampton. When I was a student, we saw Black excellence all over the place. We had the likes of Jesse Jackson and some of the civil rights figures on campus talking to us. And not only that, it's just through our professors. And so when we see that kind of excellence, we become that, right? And it's in an environment where it is appreciated and it is celebrated, and that we don't have to make excuses. And so this administration has done a great job understanding that and investing in that. And so, you know, as I said before, this is an administration who understands the importance of our schools, the value of our schools, and they have invested extremely well in our schools.
Thank you so much. That is Dr. Deetra Trent, the leader of the White House's initiative and commitment to historically Black colleges and universities, celebrating HBCU Week at the White House. Thank you so much, Dr. Trent, for your work and for sharing a little bit of you and the Biden-Harris administration's commitment to Black and brown folks with us this afternoon.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Take care. I just wanted to highlight a couple of the facts that Dr. Trent shared with us, because as I read through the briefing document, I was incredibly moved and impressed. HBCUs, and Dr. Trent mentioned these things, HBCUs produce an astonishing 40% of all Black engineers, 50% of Black teachers, 70% of Black doctors and dentists, and 80% of Black judges, and of course, the first Black female vice president and the first Black female that's going to be president of the United States.
Yeah, that's a pretty big resume there.
I would say, here's this. Research by the United Negro College Fund found that as compared to the Ivy League and other top-ranked non-HBCU institutions. HBCUs help more than five times as many students move from the bottom 40% to the top 60% of U.S. household income. About 30% of HBCU students move up at least two income quintiles compared to 18% of non-HBCUs. I mean, that is a huge... HBCUs help move people up the economic ladder.
It's almost like a hillbilly going to Harvard or Yale isn't as the actual story compared to what the real story of people
of color at HBCUs.
Yeah.
Here's the other thing, in case anybody's getting their undies in a twist out there. You don't have to be black to go to an HBCU.
You do not.
Really good friend of mine from high school, ran cross country with him. White dude, tall, lanky white dude. He went to Howard.
Great.
I thought that was...
Howard's a great university. I'd like to go to Howard.
Thing. Yeah. Listen, it would have been... I went to an undergraduate institution. They paid me to go there. I'm deeply appreciative, but it was white, so white when I was there. It's still a challenge at many institutions of higher learning. And listen, just like nearly every Harvard Business School analysis has proven to date, the more diverse a board of directors is, the more diversity you get in, not just the boardroom, but up and down your workforce, both in leadership and your frontline workers. The higher the profits, the better the business does. And I believe education is always better when we've got a lot of different people in the classrooms coming together with the breadth of experience that folks from different backgrounds, different races, different socioeconomic backgrounds bring to the table. One of the reasons, I'll share this little story with you. I got into Boston College, as well as a number of very prestigious universities, Duke. And I visited these. My parents were very helpful. They helped me go check these places out because you got to get a feel for the campus. And versions of the story I'm about to share happened at a couple of these different universities. But what happened to me at Boston College was the most shocking because it was the most stark. And so when I talk about diversity, I don't just mean gender or sexual orientation, sexual identity, race, background. I also mean socioeconomically. Because this is what happened to me when I was visiting Boston College. And I did extremely well, but BC, back when I was entering college, was astoundingly expensive. It still is. And I was sitting in the student center waiting for my tour guide. Or one tour guide was there. We were waiting for the other one. And she said, "Do you have questions about BC?" And I said, "Sure. What sort of both need and academically based scholarships, work, study, or other arrangements do you have on campus? What sort of support do you have for students that do have to balance work and study?" Because my family wasn't in a position to be cutting big old fatty checks every year before we've even touched room and board and books and food. And she turned to me with the most puzzled of expressions on her face. And she said, I'm fairly certain we have programs for disadvantaged students. And I remember kind of looking at my dad like, well, what's this girl talking about? Disadvantaged. You are not disadvantaged if your family doesn't have $60,000, $70,000 in cash. You're normal. Like, that's normal.
Yeah.
You're advantaged beyond the reach of most of Americans if your family can't cut those types of checks. And her inability to see that her experience was privileged and extraordinary and offered her advantages that most of us could never dream of, yet alone cash in, and I mean that literally, told me all I needed to know about BC. It put me off of places like Duke, UNC, Chapel Hill, put me off Michigan as an out-of-stater, put me off the University of Chicago, because the price tags attached to this and the low percentage of kids that were there on some mix of both need-based aid, scholarship, Pell Grants, told me these were going to be, this was not going to be a classroom where a wealth of experience and viewpoint and lived differences were going to be brought to bear in how I learned economics or history or literature, because it impacts how you understand and relate to that information and how you test it or how you test each other's ideas. And to this day, I think that that is one of the greatest inhibiting factors. People talk about liberal elites. I go, we're talking about rich people elites. That's what we're actually talking about. I don't care if you're conservative or liberal or independent. You got 70, 80 large that you can cut a check to send your kid to whatever the best school they can get into is. That makes you an elite, not your politics. I guess my rant on that is over for this afternoon.
To add to that, you know, when I had my first black teacher when I was in college, and I thought I was kind of, you know, enlightened and whatnot. But it wasn't until he explained to me that when he had to have heart surgery and how hard it was for him to put his literal heart in a white man's hands, yeah, and how hard that was, until I realized, wow, I really don't know anything, do I?
And to the texter from the 414 that said that HBCUs still suck. Well, then Ivy League schools suck more because they don't raise people out of lower income quartiles at the rate that HBCUs. They do not produce doctors and lawyers and dentists at the same rate that HBCUs do. They perpetuate wealth generationally, because what is Harvard? By Harvard graduates' admission, the most expensive networking event you will ever attend. Welcome, if you're just joining me. You're going to want to keep it locked into the top of the hour for the Dom Salvia Show, because it is Civic Media's statewide text to win, Go for the Green or Gold contest. Dom's going to be dropping the word of the hour on you. We'll pick one winner every hour in the 7 a.m., 11 a.m., 1 p.m., and 4 o'clock hours to win either $100 in cash or gold jewelry. That will also get you entered to win a pair of indoor club-level tickets to see the Green and Gold in Green Bay on Monday, December 23rd against New Orleans. Get ready for that contest. Go to your app store, download the Civic Media app, pick one of the stations, and get ready to text. There's a button at the bottom of your screen to get you entered on the statewide for the Green and Gold Text to Win contest. Your word of the hour coming up in the 4 o'clock hour with Dom Salvia. But before you get there, I had one of our colleagues at Civic Media, Brian, today, asked me about why the heck Donald Trump gets to vote in November since he's a convicted felon.
It is a question that I've been asked several times.
And I knew the answer, more or less. But then I looked it up and knew some more about it. My answer was because he hasn't been sentenced yet. And indeed, that is part of the reason. But there are some wrinkles here, and I thought I would share this with everybody because I was interested in the answer. I learned some things. I figured everybody else would as well. So unless Donald Trump is incarcerated for his felonies in New York State at the time of the election, or convicted in a different jurisdiction that takes away his right to vote merely for being convicted, he's going to be able to vote in Florida, which is different than a Floridian who is convicted and yet not yet sentenced in Florida of a felony. Let me explain. Under Florida law, a, quote, felony conviction in another state makes a person ineligible to vote in Florida only if the conviction would make the person ineligible to vote in the state where the person was convicted. Okay? So, a mere conviction in New York State does not render you, for a felony conviction in the state of New York does not render you ineligible to vote. You actually have to be doing time. Again, under New York law, a person convicted of a felony is disenfranchised only while incarcerated for that felony. And that court has bumped his sentencing back to after the election. We are unlikely, near certain, to not that we will not see a trial in the Georgia case, in the Florida documents case, or in the January 6th insurrection case out of D.C. before the election. So Trump will be able to vote. Now, what's a little messed up about all of this is that if Trump had been convicted of those same felonies in Florida and not yet sentenced and not yet spending any time, not yet incarcerated, he wouldn't be able to vote in Florida. Because people in Florida convicted of a felony other than murder or some sort of sexual offense in Florida state or federal court, folks, do not get to vote. They are disenfranchised during incarceration, during their probation, during their parole, during any type of community supervision. And here's the kicker in Florida, Brian. And until those people have paid off any fines, fees, court costs, or other restitution ordered by the court. Guess what? It's nearly impossible for a lot of convicted people to do, even if it was like low-level drug crimes that they were convicted of, even at a felony level, is pay all the court fees and fines.
Is that why they have such a problem with bail bonds and the issue with... It seems like there's an issue there.
Yeah, I don't want to get it conflated with what cash bail systems and bonds.
No, I know. I'm just saying it's like another complication based on that.
It's another way to keep a goodly number of people from voting. And I didn't want to leave that discussion without telling Wisconsin voters, if you have been convicted of a crime, how these rules work in Wisconsin, okay? The ACLU of Wisconsin, I'll get there, Brian. I'll get there, everybody. The ACLU of Wisconsin, that's where I went to look this up. If you have been convicted of a misdemeanor, you do not and will never, or at least to date, unless they change the constitution of the state, if you're just convicted of a misdemeanor, you don't lose your right to vote. You can still vote. This means even if you are in jail or prison and the underlying conviction is a misdemeanor, or if you are still on paper, if the underlying conviction is a misdemeanor, you may still vote. However, if you were convicted of a felony or any treason or bribery crime in the state of Wisconsin, you must finish your sentence and be off paper. That means off probation, parole, and extended supervision. Okay? If you do not know if you are off paper, call your parole or probation officer. You do not have to get a pardon or permission to vote once you are off paper for your felony to vote again in Wisconsin. Now, if you have been charged with a felony but not yet convicted, you can vote. But in the state of Wisconsin, if you're like Donald Trump and you've been charged, convicted, but not yet sentenced, you cannot vote. I'll probably revisit this before voting day.
Maggie, I think it's amazing that one of the people running for the president of the United States starts this conversation as to whether he can vote or not because he's a convicted felon 34 times.
Yeah, and it's a little through the looking glass, folks. It's another day in the news in the United States, I guess, in Wisconsin. If you don't know about this stuff or you've got a question, just go to the ACLU webpage. That's ACLU-WI.org. They'll help explain this to you. That's where we're going to leave it today. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. The Green or Gold Text to Win statewide contest starts at the top of the hour on the Dom Salvia Show up next.
In 4 years, you don't have to. We'll have it fixed so good you're not going to have to vote.